Now, last week, Monday, we were doing a comparison of the end results of what happens in meditation or pure prayer by comparing it with the statements of St. John of the Cross and with the works and with them that mentioned in the Hui Ming Ching. And I would like to go on from where we were, remembering that every one of them had the same starting point, a desire, an earnest longing to return to God, usually as a result of some trauma, but not necessarily so, that every one of them required an investigation into one's past existence, both in this life and in other lives. The Christians, interestingly enough, there is a piece about that in St. John of the Cross, which he has skated around with incredible care so that no one shall know that that's what he's actually talking about. Everyone, therefore, has to clean up their life in order to get the first glimpse or to have the first kensho, to become the stream entrant, as Buddhism calls it. In order to have this first kensho, these things are essential. In order to have the second one, one starts again, not quite in the same beginning place as one did before, but a little further up the line, and this time one has to take the precepts absolutely after cleaning up that which one has done in past lives as well as in this one. Then comes the third one. Now, it is the third one that is the most difficult to speak about, because in this, in the end, one has to give up even meditation. In other words, one goes beyond meditation to what St. John of the Cross calls contemplation. And it is contemplation that is being spoken of at the end of the Hui Ming Ching. Now, I would like to give you some of the points that St. John of the Cross makes. First of all, about the danger of enjoying the fruits of meditation. Tremendous number of people, as I've told you, after a certain distance, especially after having had a first kensho, proceed to get a certain amount of visions and a certain amount of what St. John of the Cross calls religious consolations. And St. John warns against them, not that they are bad of themselves, but that simply they make the soul, or in the case of Buddhism, the Buddha nature, run around in circles because they're so attractive. And because they are so attractive, the soul says, why do any more? This is really comfortable. Why not stay here? But one has to go on further. There is a much, much higher thing than just the consolations of spiritual joy. One has to go much higher and much further. St. John's words are the following. Any kind of withdrawal from the world or reformation of life may suffice for some. Some are content with a certain degree of virtue, perseverance, and success in prayer, but never achieve the true nakedness, poverty, selflessness, or spiritual purity, which in fact are all the same, that the Lord counsels us to have. For they still feed and clothe their natural selves with spiritual feelings, and console themselves with these spiritual feelings, rather than divesting and denying themselves of them in order to reach the supreme experience. And this is, of course, the main problem of having visions in meditation. They are very enjoyable. As I said last week, any time you have a vision of hell, you know that you don't want a repeat performance. Any time you have a vision of heaven, it can be very, very attractive. But they are not wrong. Do not get the impression they are wrong. And later, St. John himself admits to this, making it very clear that they are not wrong. Just don't get so in, don't enjoy them to such an extent that you give up what else you can get. He says later, on much the same subject, 24:8. These things do not happen until people become truly spiritual, and I would like to persuade such spiritual persons that the road leading to God, or the cosmic Buddha, does not entail a multiplicity of considerations, methods, manners, and experiences, though by their own way these may be a requirement and even of considerable use to beginners. It demands, however, only one thing, the true removal of all self, i.e. true self-denial. In this exercise of true self-denial, everything else, and even more, is discovered and accomplished, for one goes beyond nothingness. Therefore, do not get caught up with the joys that meditation or true prayer can bring. Go on beyond them, much, much further beyond them. Then goes on to give a detailed but Western version of the Sandokai in saying the following. The first kind of knowledge referred to in the preceding chapter is that which originates naturally. Since we already discussed this kind of knowledge in the first book, there is no need to discuss it here. Our discussion in this chapter deals with the supernatural knowledge which reaches the intellect and the spirit by way of the exterior bodily senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. Through these senses, spiritual persons can, and usually do, perceive supernatural representations and objects. For this is an extraordinarily good method and an extraordinarily good doorway of entering into the spiritual state. Now, do you remember I gave a lecture explaining how the morning scriptures worked and how important it was to understand the purpose of the Sandokai? The Sandokai, to a certain extent, is your yardstick by which you measure the degree of sensitivity that you have now reached. You look back upon yourself and see how much more sensitive you are now than you were when you first started. If you cannot understand through the gateway of the senses, how will you ever find the truth, no matter how far distant you may walk, says the scripture. And here St. John of the Cross is saying, the senses are awfully valuable. Don't get rid of them. What he does say, however, is don't indulge them. His self-annihilation that people have talked about, and which has been carried to extreme by a number of people, simply means this. Do not overindulge any of your senses. It does not mean that you get rid of them. In fact, all throughout this work, The Ascent of Mount Carmel, he speaks of how important they are, especially for beginners, as yardsticks to check their own spiritual growth. In other words, when you no longer see a tree as just a something that's standing out there, oh yes, there are trees about, oh yes, there's this, there's that, when you no longer look at it that way and see instead that it is an expression of the cosmic Buddha or of God, that it is an exquisite thing, and then when you start having gratitude for it, because it gives you shade or food, then you are beginning to become more sensitive to the Buddha nature or God nature of that which is around you. If you cannot find God through the experience of your senses, it may be simply by touching a cat's fur, or seeing a baby's smile. It doesn't matter what you use, so long as you become more sensitive to what is actually going on and see what is really and truly there, instead of just taking everything for granted. So these are some of the things that it is necessary for a person to do if he would truly find some greater spiritual state. He then goes on to speak of something else. After a bit, when one has had these senses awakened in this way, one begins to perceive a super set of senses, as it were. He speaks of them thus. Through hearing, they begin to apprehend certain extraordinary words within their own hearts, sometimes from envisioned persons, and at other times without seeing them, or seeing the one who actually speaks. He speaks of this later and says how valuable it is when one has truly reached a truly spiritual state, for this is, in fact, the Holy Spirit, and how one has conversations with God. And the seniors and I at Shasta know that this place can be apprehended through meditation. And one does hold conversations with something that is definitely superior to oneself. Whether one prefers to call it God or the cosmic Buddha or the Buddha nature or the Holy Spirit does not terribly much matter. And the other thing that you need to remember is what I told you at the last lecture. It is terribly important to remember that this is not something that is solely for saints. It is for every living human being. The Buddhism itself teaches that everyone has the duty to find this place, to find this exquisite place. And as I also told you, one of the monks with whom I have been corresponding in England has pointed out that although most Christians don't know it, that is their duty also. They are not supposed to just expect the saints to do it. Every single human being is supposed to do it. In other words, we have allowed our... our standards to drop throughout the centuries and have been selling ourselves short spiritually for about the last 1,000 years, which is a great shame. We should aspire to much higher things and not think that they are solely for people in monasteries, solely for priests. They are for every living person. He continues, with the sense of smell, as it improves, they sometimes notice sensibly the sweetest fragrances without knowledge of their origin. Also it happens in regard to taste that they experience very exquisite savors. And concerning touch, they feel extreme delight, at times so intense that all the bones and marrow rejoice, flourish, and bathe in it. Now, do you remember I spoke to you of what happens when one bathes in the spiritual fountain during meditation? Here is the Christian equivalent of exactly the same thing. Saint Julian of Norwich speaks of it much more graphically, and Saint Teresa of Avila even more graphically still. This delight is usually termed spiritual unction. Extreme unction in the Catholic Church is a form of anointing with holy oils at the time of shortly before death. And if you experience this, as I'm sure you all will if you meditate deeply enough, if you ever experience this, it is a feeling of anointing, as I told you in the earlier days, with something like one person described it as a warm, honey-like substance. It doesn't much matter what you call it. I call it water. Some call it honey. Others call it by various names, but they are always liquid. I like the Catholic term for it, spiritual unction. In our own language, that is far better, I think, than some of the things I have translated it into from the Japanese. I'm keeping the word in mind. This delight is usually termed spiritual unction because in pure souls it passes from the spirit to the senses, and it is common with spiritual persons. It is an overflow from the affection and devotion of the sensible spirit which each person receives in his own way. Now you remember in the Sandokai, it says, and as each thing, as leaves return unto the roots, each thing returns unto the source. One notices the substances changing. One notices the deeper sensitivity of everything around you. And one day, this thing happens, and the sensitivity becomes so exquisite, so unbelievably exquisite, that one has made it, as it were, from the worldly back to one's rightful place. Back to being a truly spiritual being. And then he gives a warning. However, it must be known that even though these apprehensions come to the bodily senses from God, one must never rely on them or accept them and do nothing more. A man should have no desire to determine what they are, but continue his meditation. That might have come straight out of Dogen, who says, don't worry about what happens, keep going straight on. But above all, do not turn away from them. Do not think they don't happen. Don't try to pretend they don't happen. And don't let somebody talk you into believing that they're not good. It doesn't matter whether they are good or bad. They are signs of the fact that you are working spiritually. And keep going. I've often thought of them as beautiful things in shop windows. Supposing you are going along a really... I'm a female and I like to look in shops, all right? I'm going along a road of shops with really beautiful clothes in them, and no matter how much of a monk I become, if I see something really good in a shop, I'm going to look at it, all right? Now, it's fine so long as I don't keep coming back to the window and thinking how good it is. If I do that, I will never get from one end of the road to the other, which is where I'm actually trying to go. But that doesn't mean that what is in the shop window is bad. It simply means that I should not get hooked on it. Right. He does make a couple of very valuable points from the point of view of Zen. The more exterior these corporal objects and forms, the less profitable they are to the interior and spiritual part of the soul. A nice point. And the reason for this is that if the corporal vision or feeling of the senses has a divine origin, it produces its effect in the spirit at the very moment of its perception, without allowing any deliberation about wanting or not wanting it. This is when it is completely and absolutely safe. In other words, when you do not go hunting after it, but when it happens simultaneously. Another very important point. I have known people come to me and say, I badly, badly want to meditate because I want out-of-body experiences. And the instant somebody says that to me, I know that he does not want any real spiritual progress to take place within himself. What he does want is something that he can, I think the modern term is groove on. And that is not what religion is. I love the way in which St. John puts this. It is so, in many respects, much clearer almost than Dogen. It's all right at the moment of perception, so long as you're not trying to deliberate whether you want it or not. And he goes on to say, this is likewise so with the more interior communications, such as voices from God. Since God grants these favors without the individual's own ability and effort, he causes the desired effect of these favors without this ability and effort, for this is an effect he produces passively in the spirit. The good effect accordingly does not depend upon wanting or not wanting the communications. In other words, they just come and do not deliberately set out to try and get them. If they come, they come. If they don't come, they don't come. And it doesn't matter two hoots whether they do or whether they don't. When they come, rejoice. When they don't come, rejoice. Gives another very good reason for not wanting them also. The soul begins to develop a possessive attitude toward these communications and fails to continue on its journey to genuine renunciation and nakedness of spirit. It is, in fact, like a child playing with joyous toys. Do not stay in such a place. Spiritual persons, after having exercised themselves in meditation to approach God through images, forms, and meditation suitable for beginners err greatly if they do not determine, dare, or know how to detach themselves from these actual methods. For God then wishes to lead them to more spiritual, interior, and invisible graces by removing the gratification derived from meditation. Now, this is perhaps the most difficult thing for the average person to understand. One has to even give up the gratification, the comfort that meditation gives. Because you see, if you stick to meditation, there is meditation and there is work. There is a time when you meditate and there is a time when you are doing other things. But one has to go on beyond that to a time when there is neither. To a place that St. John of the Cross calls contemplation, and to which Dogen calls just doing that which has to be done, or training for training's sake. That is a very graphic description of contemplation. And the only way one can read that, the only way one can reach, that, is if one truly does not pay any court to the gratifications that come, including the joy of the experiencing even of the spiritual unction. It is exquisite, but if one holds on to it, one cannot grow spiritually. There then sits in what can best be described an aridity of soul, or aridity of spirit. And it is this which is the last real hurdle, in a way, that a spirit has to overcome, at any rate, in this particular lifetime. Please understand that what I am talking about is still only the tip of the iceberg, spiritually. But this is the last big hurdle. Things by which one judges whether it is opportune for a spiritual person to discontinue meditation because he has got beyond its usefulness. For it and daily work are the last pair of practical opposites, just as the last pair of spiritual opposites are bodhisattva and arahant. And if one gets caught in either, one cannot go on to Buddhahood. So are the last pair of physical obstacles, meditation and daily life. One has to go on beyond them. In other words, one has to discover that heaven and earth are all one, and not be bothered by either, not wanting either, not pushing either away. How to live in this exquisite place of contemplation, which is beyond both, without necessarily having to meditate or not meditate. What then are the signs that it is necessary to go on? The first is the realization that one cannot make meditation or receive satisfaction from it as one did before. There is a longing for something much, much more. That's the first sign. There's a dryness, as I said, an aridity. Dryness is now the outcome of fixing the senses upon objects which formerly provided satisfaction. However, as long as one can meditate and draw out satisfaction, one must not abandon the method. Meditation must only be discontinued when the soul, or Buddha nature, is placed in that peace and quietude to be spoken of in the third sign. Going up through the dark night of the soul is scary. Going up through the Gedo Valley is scary, especially if you look down. Going through the aridity to the final, complete, and absolute union is the scariest of all. Because whereas you knew you didn't like it when you first started, it is now so beautiful, there is almost the thought that you are abandoning God or abandoning the cosmic Buddha by going on. There is almost a feeling that you are ungrateful. And yet there is this thing which says, do not stop here, do not stay here, go on. And that place which is eventually reached is contemplation. Now, in the lotus blossom, I spoke last week of that place of contemplation, and here in the Hui Ming Ching, you have exactly the same thing being said that St. John of the Cross said. The shapes formed by the spirit fire are only empty colors and forms. Do not be worried. Do not cling to all these beautiful visions, etc. They are only empty things. The light of human nature, or the light of the Buddha nature, or the soul, shines back on the primordial, or the cosmic Buddha or God, which is the true. The two just bathe in each other. There is just a being in each other, which is a permanent state, because it is a permanent state of love, contemplation. I hesitate to use the term mutual admiration, but if you can think of that in its highest and very best form, that is really what it comes down to. Mutual adoration, perhaps, will be closer to it. The imprint of the heart, that is, the heart-mind, or the cosmic Buddha, or the Buddha nature, floats free, untarnished, the moonlight shines. When this has been reached, the boat of life has reached the shore, and bright shines the sunlight. The two just living together, joying in each other, feeling absolute, complete gratitude for each other. The fifth chapter of the Shushogi. Just living in this exquisite contemplation. And then he goes on to describe it without beginning, without end, without past and without future. A halo of light surrounds the world of the law. We forget one another, quiet and pure, altogether powerful and altogether empty. The emptiness is irradiated by the light of the heart and of heaven. That is an exact description of the state of contemplation. Now, the second sign that proves that we are going on beyond meditation is an awareness of a disinclination to fix the mind upon anything particular, exterior or interior. That means in the sense of imagining something to which there can possibly be an opposite. Just a desire, in other words, to just sit. Not a desire to see gods and angels, or to be fighting demons. Just a desire to be. A disinclination to fix oneself, to fix the mind on anything, just a desire to be, that and nothing more. The third and surest sign is that a person likes to remain alone in loving awareness of God or the cosmic Buddha, without particular considerations, in interior peace and quiet and repose, and without the acts and exercises of the intellect, memory, and will, and that he prefers to remain only in the general loving awareness and knowledge we mentioned, without any particular knowledge or understanding. As I put towards the end of the lotus blossom, it is sufficient for me to know the cosmic Buddha. That is all in the end that you need. You do not need visions. You do not need miraculous signs. You need absolutely nothing. It is sufficient for me to know the cosmic Buddha, to remain in quiet, loving peace, and to love to be alone. And the soul, or Buddha nature, will do some quite remarkable things to make sure that it gets at least a couple of hours a day after what this place has been reached in which to be alone. It will do some quite incredible things to make this happen. I have known it make some of the monks in the Far East take up very odd sort of hobbies which nobody else wanted to join them in. Which is fine, they were perfectly good hobbies, but some of the people who were around them thought maybe they were being a little childish. I can remember one learned old monk who played with trains, which a lot of people thought was very odd. There are good reasons for doing this, however. It ensures at least an hour or two of being alone with God. No more about that one. Okay. He then speaks about how important it is not to have the third without the other two. It is insufficient to possess the first, the realization that one cannot go on with meditation, without the second, which is an awareness, as I said, a disinclination to want the signs. And you can't really reach the third unless you go through the aridity that comes with the first two. And then he gives one of his lovely pieces after telling everybody how unwise it is to have all these visions and the like and get attached to them. He then says something which is very comforting and which my own master said to me on a number of occasions. We did not mean that those beginning to have this general loving knowledge should never again try to meditate. In the beginning of this state, the habit of contemplation is not so perfect that one cannot will enter into this act. Neither is it one so remote from discursive meditation as to be always incapable of it. One can meditate naturally through forms and scenes as before and discover something new in them. So do not immediately discard meditation. And if you ever feel a desire for it, do not think that you are putting yourself back down by going back to meditating. There are times to meditate and are times just to sit and contemplate. And if the urge or the desire to meditate comes on, then go on and do it. Nobody is going to think any less of you because that is what you do. When the spiritual person cannot meditate, he should learn how to remain in God's or the cosmic Buddha's presence with a loving attention and a tranquil intellect, even though he seems to himself to be idle. Now, this is very important. For little by little, and very soon, the divine calm and peace, with a wondrous sublime knowledge of God, enveloped in divine love, will be infused into his soul, or Buddha nature. He should not interfere with forms or meditations and imaginings. Otherwise, his soul will be disquieted and drawn out of its peaceful contentment to distaste and repugnance. He should not have any scruples about his inactivity. He should remember that pacification of soul is no small accomplishment, no matter what the rest of the world may think of him. In other words, if you're sitting seeming to do nothing, or as happened in the early days when I started to run Shasta, there were people who really didn't know how to sit still, and I used the television set as a sort of babysitter what time I sat at the back of the room and just stayed very nice and happily in this state. The only trouble coming when we'd watched the same thing two or three times in a row and I hadn't noticed. And somebody would say, but we watched this last week. One should understand that such behavior is not idleness of spirit. To sit and bathe in the presence of the cosmic Buddha is not an idle occupation. And one should not worry what the world thinks about it. If you worry about it, you will immediately lose what he calls here the pacification of soul. Two types of knowledge. The object of the one kind is the creator or God or the cosmic Buddha, and the other is the creature. Both kinds bring intense delight to the spirit. The contemplation of the beauty of everything that is of God, whether man has taken it and fashioned it or not, and the contemplation of that which could in the beginning create it. This is one of the most beautiful meditations that one can enjoy, and one which is especially exquisite towards evening. After a bit, the Buddha nature within one has certain things that it really loves to dwell upon at certain hours of the day. One does this with food at meal times, the exquisiteness of the food whilst not desiring it. One can do this in the evening, looking at the colors that the sun creates and the state of the trees and the birds, or even the things around you in a city. All of these things can be contemplated, loved, and felt gratitude for. There is nothing which is thrown out or excluded from this gratitude. Do not long for 2,000 years ago, says Shakyamuni Buddha, says Keizan Zenji, and do not long to be somewhere where you are not, because there I could find it. I am sure you have seen those ads on TV which show people having a marvelous time in some wonderful resort or other in some part of the world. And you've been to these places at some time or other, and you know you didn't have this marvelous time. There was a wasp buzzing around your cream cake, or there was a mosquito biting you somewhere, or there was somebody making a noise down the street, or there was a revolting stink somewhere. And you know that it is not this beautiful, idyllic thing if you cannot find it where you are right now, in this particular place, if you cannot look around this room and see the hand of God or the hand of the cosmic Buddha, then you are never going to find it if you hunt from now till doomsday. The contentment with what you have is a very important point here. One must always be content with what one has and what there is. God is the direct, or the cosmic Buddha, is the direct object of this knowledge, in that one of his attributes is sublimely experienced. And as often as this experience occurs, it remains fixed in the soul, or the Buddha nature. Since this communication is pure contemplation, the soul clearly understands that it is ineffable, A person is capable of describing it only through general expressions. Expressions caused by the abundance and delight of these experiences. But he realizes the impossibility of explaining with these expressions what he tasted and felt in these exquisite communications. This divine knowledge of God never deals with particular things, since its object is the supreme principle. Consequently, one cannot express it in particular terms, unless a truth about something less than God is seen together with this knowledge of him. But in no way can anything be said of that divine knowledge itself. Zen has always said that it is impossible to explain the highest form of meditation. It is beyond words, it can only be experienced. Here St. John of the Cross is saying exactly the same thing. It is beyond words, it can only be experienced. When you experience it, you will know it. When you are in this exquisite place, you will know it. But you cannot say that you are enlightened. You only know when you are not in this exquisite place. Because if you call it enlightenment, you put a label upon it. And then you limit God or the cosmic Buddha. And such a limitation is not a possibility. You can simply run your hand, as it were, through a river and know the feel of water. You can never hold the water in your hand. And I would like you to remember the following. The external signs that are necessary, which are also signs of an internal activity. First and foremost, faith, belief that you can do it, and the determination to do so. Dogen says the secret of life is will. Words are its key. As I said last week, the secret of life is really to be willing, and words are its key. To be willing, no matter what God or the cosmic Buddha wants. So first and foremost, faith, and the willingness to go no matter where it may lead, and the willingness to go on, however attractive things may have become. The second is to look at what you have done in the past, of which you are ashamed, stand up straight, admit to yourself that you have done it, because so many people as a result of shame are afraid to admit to themselves what they have and have not done. So admit to yourself honestly what you have done and try to put as much of it right as you humanly possibly can. To take the precepts absolutely, study them as completely as you can and try to keep them as completely as you can in the spirit of the three pure precepts. To cease from evil, to do only good, and to do good for other people, without allowing them to do wrong. Without setting up, in other words, a situation that will allow them to do wrong. You can't stop a person doing wrong if he's intending to do it. But you can set up a situation in such a way that you will not encourage him to do so. The next, having done that, is to develop the mind of the Bodhisattva. That is the mind of charity, benevolence, tenderness, and sympathy. And when you have done this, when you have grown your lotus blossom, to just sit in that lotus blossom, as it were, even if it is only in front of a TV screen, to sit in that lotus blossom and contemplate in gratitude and joy, in a state of mutual adoration, the cosmic Buddha. For that is the highest form of meditation. In that highest form of meditation, there are no visions, no wondrous happenings, no comings, no goings, just a certain knowledge that is complete, as St. John says, complete and absolute pacification of soul. And in that pacification of soul lies everything. My master used to say that a snail carried his house with him wherever he went, and he died within his own house. The true house is the pacification of soul, which is the cosmic Buddha itself.
In the Lotus Book, you, on page 145, you said, the greatest prayer I know is, quote, Lord, give me the time and the knowledge to make the right decisions concerning my life before I meet you face to face.
Yes.
I thought that was just marvelous. But how does one go about
making, knowing that they are the right decisions?
Yes, and just making them, and just knowing that
to make the right decisions.
Not me.
Interestingly enough, St. John of the Cross talks about that. It was something I thought of trying to get into this lecture and then decided that I wouldn't probably be able to. I'll see if I can find it for you because it's really fascinating. Not at all. Please close it. Yes. He speaks somewhat further along. Yes, of the interior words formally and supernaturally produced in the spirit. He actually speaks of them. If you've got a copy of this book, I strongly recommend you.
I would like to know where to get one.
Well, it's in chapter 30, at any rate, the answer to your question. All right? How's that? And it's the Ascent of Mount Carmel. And I can show you the passages that I've marked here afterwards. It's quite a short chapter. But it is absolutely fascinating how it says you can tell what is the true voice and what is not, and how you check it. I thought only Buddhism knew how to do that one. The thing that's angering me is that Christianity, as I said in the last lecture, has got all this stuff, but they never talk about it to anybody. So naturally the young go off hunting elsewhere. What do they expect?
Go ahead. Churches were terribly interested in channeling people into true
spirituality.
It's very sort of private, monastic, and not just be a dutiful churchgoer. They almost discourage you from doing that.
Buddhism does the exact opposite. You are the most undutiful of beings if you don't go into this stuff. If you do not make some sort of genuine progress in this direction. And yet, Father Hilary said that this was the rightful occupation even in Christianity, and that the fathers had always said.
I don't think the ministers I've known my life didn't know this themselves, I don't think. I never got the feeling they knew it. I think they were giving us exactly what they knew.
Yeah.
And those who did know were probably off someplace hidden, like a few that you know, but they're not the ones who are in the churches and the cities.
Well, it's an awful shame.
Yeah,
because
sure.
People are running around in circles looking for this.
Yeah.
And every single one of them has exactly the same set of steps. I mean, whether it's Taoist, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, they're all doing exactly the same thing. And I could actually make up, and I possibly may do, for the monks at Shasta, and if we do this course next year, we can use it down here, an actual chart of where to find it in your tradition. I mean, why not? After all, what we're looking for is God. Who cares where you find it, so long as you realize that everybody's doing the same thing. Go ahead, friend.
There's a Indian philosopher who did that with the Bible, including the New Testament, and everything in the New Testament says that.
I know it does. It's infuriating that people try to turn it into something else. Yes, you had something, didn't you?
I guess it's really an extension of her question. I'm not sure how to ask it more deeply than that. Sometimes in your training, some of the things your teacher says sinks. Occasionally that happens.
Yeah, if he says them often enough.
Okay. And you begin to think that it's possible that the ways you've headed to try to head yourself toward God are not so much the way as a rut. And it might be good to get out of this rut and to do something. You were talking about one aspect of this a bit further on, was you almost felt like you were being ungrateful. When you're doing something really different from what you have always thought was good to do, even asking, is it good, of the Lord of the House, sometime you get a pretty creepy feeling about it. Is there any attitude of mind that, or is there any way?
The way I have dealt with it is this. I will not move from where I am. I will not go to some other dusty place. Now, I may do something different externally, or I may seem to do something different externally, but I am not going to move from here. I am not going to become somebody else's disciple and throw over Kōhō Zenji. I am not going to throw over Sōtō Zen because I think that Catholicism has got more of it. I can find it where I am right now. And I am not going to worry about this fact that I am now presently, shall we say, in an arid state. And this is where faith comes in. Just keep the faith bright that you can find it wherever you happen to be.
And this willingness to always be willing to offer it up, to be willing to be where you are, even if you're doing something that feels very scary, as long as you're willing...
So long as you trust the cosmic Buddha or the Lord of the House or God, the one thing that God will never do is destroy either you or himself.
And as long as you're honestly trying to follow the teaching rather than trying to set yourself or yourself up.
Yes.
Even if you make a big mistake, you'll be aware of it.
Yes, and still come back. However big the mistake may be, don't think that that has cut you off and that you can never come back. Occasionally we've had people in Shasta, as you know, who've made fairly big mistakes and they thought, oh, we ought to leave and we ought to do something like this. And occasionally somebody said to me, well, why don't you let them go? And I usually say, well, fine, if they really want to. But they should know that a big mistake doesn't mean that you have to go. Very important to know that there is no mistake so grave that you cannot forgive yourself for making it. It's not God's problem to forgive you or not forgive you. God is God. It's your problem that you forgive yourself for being an idiot. And so often we feel foolish and we say, oh, well, I can't really go back there. I feel too big a fool. And on a much more serious scale, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Because as you said, when you reach the point after death...
God doesn't see fools.
Yeah. And you're standing there in front of God. There's no judgment there.
No.
So if you're judging yourself throughout your life, in a sense, then you're not trying to see God.
That's right.
And that's what you're doing.
You are looking at the little self.
Yeah.
And there's so much I've had to leave out of this, so much that I've... That was why I was hoping you could all get these books.
Do you think we might be able to through a Catholic bookstore?
Do
you know?
It should be.
Dark Matter of the Soul, and it's the
Yes, I know. I have that, but I like this better.
It's bigger than you do.
Well, I just... It reads better.
It's a better translation, yes. This is a beauty, this one.
Yes, I want this.
I don't know.
It's available up here from the Institute of Carmelite Studies, ICS Publications. I believe that's in Washington, D.C.
Well, you can get it on Geary Street, 46 Geary Street in San Francisco.
That's useful information. Thank you.
St. Paul's Catholic bookstore.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
The Graduate Theological Union bookstore over here will have some by the end of the month.
I'm sorry that you're going to have to take my word for it. With regard to St. Teresa of Avila and the works of the Jewish works, but you know what the books are, and you can easily prove me right or wrong. So you've got the book list. Go ahead.
I'm kind of confused. Like, I know these both points are right, and I'm confused about putting them together. The one
right.
You just made, you know, about how. It's really up to you to forgive yourself. It isn't really God's job. It's your kind of number.
Well, he's beyond the opposite.
He's what?
He is beyond the opposite.
But then there's the point, too, of how important it is to try to set right what you've done wrong. And assumingly, you know, just because you've done it once doesn't mean you've got it in a nice group all together. It doesn't mean you're not going to continue to do stuff wrong and have to keep on going. You know, it
no.
seems like it must be a process.
The thing is this. you can forgive yourself for having done something, but that doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't try to do something about it.
Is it possible for a person to have an overactive conscience?
Oh, yes, I had a murderous one. I was a millipede with washcloths, not a centipede. It was terrible. I felt awfully good when I put down a number of those washcloths. What do? You learn to put them down. That's the only answer. You really have to forgive yourself.
Meditation
helps a lot. Yes, it does. Go ahead.
Isn't there some way to transcend all this karma?
To transcend karma? The law of karma is inevitable. And even the greatest Zen master is bound by the law of karma. When one has dealt with all one's karma, yes, to that extent it is transcended. One can transcend it by dealing with it in this lifetime. But it has to be dealt with. It cannot be left lying about.
There's a saying in Zen that the enlightened man is one with his karma. And actually, it could maybe better be said that an enlightened man realizes he is one with his karma. Whereas the unenlightened man constantly tries to fight against it.
And tries to escape it. Negative about cleaning up your karma.
Your karma is
no, nice. I'm talking about worrying about karma.
You don't worry about it. You don't worry about it.
It's just acceptance. Being fully accepting.
You can go ahead on. I have a different question.
We've finished it. Go ahead, friend.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that, and in some sense, there must be an acceptance that God. I'm thinking of sitting in a foxhole, mm-hmm. a war, or something like that, experiencing something, very, very violent, and very tremendous. In some senses, it almost sounds as if one needs to accept the fact that God can be manifest in very violent ways.
I can remember sitting in a cellar whilst the Germans were bombing my hometown. And I had not been a terribly religious person. I was barely 16. And a lot of things started coming up for me as to what on earth was the point of joining this adult human race, which had just dragged me out of school, if this was their private amusement. I wasn't at all sure for a fair length of time whether I wanted to join the adult human race or not. It took me a good year after the 1940 bombings to be sure about that. And what gave me the certainty was what gave me the advisability of doing it, rather, was what I had experienced in that cellar. And that was, with all of this that was going on, there was something inside that was just sitting there and smiling. I called it something with a smile in its heart in one of my books. And it had sort of been there whenever I'd really needed help. And during the air raids, it always seemed to be sitting there. And it enabled me to go through all the air raids. Now, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Well, it's really a difficult thing to phrase for me. The sense that there's destruction and creation going on all the time. Something that just happens. And in that sense, I mean, like
But why worry about it? You can live beyond it.
But that's what I'm saying, is that in some ways there must be an acceptance of both destruction and creation.
Oh, yes, there is. It does not matter when one is in that exquisite place where the smile just sits.
Right, but the hard thing to do is if you're in a space where you're experiencing maybe violence or something that seems to be very...
I started meditating with a vengeance when I was 16, thanks to Mr. Hitler. There is no teacher quite as effective as a bombing raid. If you really want to learn to meditate fast, especially when you come out of the cellar and find five of your schoolmates have been killed. You do, however, have to accept the violence, you have to accept the death, and you have to accept the life and that there is something beyond all of it.
This being outside of the hand.
Yes. And there is nothing outside of it. And that is what I really experienced. I wouldn't have called it that when I was a youngster. That's really what I experienced sitting in that cellar. It was damp, it was cold, it was miserable. But there was this lovely warm thing sitting there. It was quite exquisite. Yes.
Mentioned sometimes you use the phrase the being that will inherit my karma, you know,
yes,
after I die. That's one thing that I've always wondered so much about is death and what survives it. When you had your Kensho experiences, did you get a certain knowledge that Peggy Kennett as such will not survive it, but the Buddha nature will?
Yes. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. Three things that I'd like to bring up. One was apropos of Reverend Rokozan's question concerning the aridity. The important reason why one should not move from a place, however arid it becomes, is because of the lack of faith it demonstrates in the cosmic Buddha. To leave such a place is literally to defame the Buddha. It is to say, I don't trust you enough to take you through this aridity. I do not trust you enough to take you through anything whatsoever. And this is the reason why one should not leave one's sitting place and go off hunting elsewhere. The other thing I wanted, two other things I wanted to mention, St. John is talking of the exquisite touches the soul feels when it does these, when it has these moments that come simultaneously, that come spontaneously rather than being sought for. They may occur upon uttering or hearing a word from Scripture or from some other source. They frequently come any time one mentions the name of the cosmic Buddha or God or the Lord of the house or anything of that sort, one's whole body will thrill with the simple joy of just the utterance. Yes. Yes. And he goes on to say why. These touches do not always have the same efficacy, nor are they always felt so forcefully, because they are often very weak. Yet no matter how weak they may be, one of these divine touches is worth more to the soul than numberless other thoughts and ideas about God's creatures and works. Since this knowledge is imparted to the soul suddenly, without exercise of its free will, a person does not have to be concerned about desiring them or not. He should simply remain humble and resigned about it, for God will do his work at the time and in the manner he himself wishes. I do not affirm that a person, therefore, should be negative about any knowledge whatsoever, as he should be with some other apprehensions.
because the knowledge, this particular knowledge, is an aspect of the union toward which we are directing the soul and which is the reason for our doctrine about it. In other words, one should enjoy these moments and not worry about what they are. Apropos of what you asked, my friend, about the voice, in chapter 29, there's some fascinating stuff. Successive words always occur when the spirit is recollected and attentively absorbed in some consideration. A person will reason about his subject, proceeding thought by thought, forming precise words and judgments, deducing and discovering such unknown truths with so much ease and clarity that it will seem to him he is doing nothing, and that another person is interiorly reasoning, answering, and teaching him. Indeed, there is every reason for this belief, since he reasons with himself and replies as if carrying on a dialogue. In a way, he really is speaking with another, for, though he reasons by using his intellect as the instrument, the Holy Spirit helps him to form these true concepts, words, and judgments. This is after he has reached this place of contemplation. And thus he utters them to himself as though to another person. Since his intellect is recollected and united with the truth, which is the subject of his thought, and the Holy Spirit is also united with him in that truth, for he is in every way truth, it results that while his intellect is thus communing with the divine spirit, by means of that truth it simultaneously forms interiorly and successively the other truths about its subject, while the Holy Spirit, the teacher or master, leads the way and gives light. This is one of the Holy Spirit's methods of teaching. The intellect, thus enlightened and taught by this master, forms propositions while understanding those truths communicated to it from elsewhere. And it goes on telling you a whole lot about it. It's interesting that it speaks of it as the master, because in Zen it is said, one calls and one answers. One calls to one's true master, and here's the true answer. Fascinating. Okay, sorry to have... those were the other two bits that I was looking for. 29 and 30 are the chapters you want.
Yes, sir.
Mm. Yes. One other thing. You said how much you preferred the poem that I got from this book than the one in there. Remember that at the time I was doing that, I was comparing what I regarded as the Western form of the Hanyu Shingyo with the original Hanyu Shingyo, and I was interweaving lines. You may have got exactly the same poem in this as you've got in that, and you were hearing some of the stuff that I was putting in between it. It's just possible. I don't know, because I don't know the other version. If he truly repented of what he'd done and tried to put it right, the answer is yes. The story of Beyond the Pale of Vengeance proves that.
Well, I mean, while he's a scoundrel, he would
not. No way. Absolutely no way. There has to be complete reformation. And there also has to be complete acceptance of the karmic consequences of what he's done. He can't get away, just walk away from what he's done.
Well, I had a feeling that if... I can't have a good meditation, probably it's because I don't have the virtues.
Oh, no, 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 no. Just don't believe that at all. You can meditate well, but you will have to deal with your old karma.
Or every you would call it the karma instead of the virtues. Or they're the same thing. Depends on how you want to look at it.
Go ahead. I heard the stirrings.
The stirrings of confusion, more than clarity.
Yeah.
Or little doubts about perhaps your personality, jealousy.
Don't ever worry about the traits in your own personality. If you worry about them, you will never be able to do anything about them. You have to not worry about them, and then you can handle them. Because when you don't worry about them, they don't grow out of proportion to what they really are. You can see them a lot more clearly.
Well, most books talk about virtue and things like that. Catholic books and other books.
A virtue is, if you will, if you want to say, talk about what true virtue is, it's being still in the midst of all of these things, personality, and then acting from the stillness. I know for myself, one of the things that got to be a real stumbling block for me was the fact that I couldn't choose a way to act that was right. And I would never live up to my own expectations of myself. And I couldn't stop myself from thinking things I didn't want to think, or feeling things I didn't want to feel. And I think as a monk, this problem is precipitated much quicker because you're in such close contact with the same people over and over and over, and with your master, who you think, if you have an unpleasant thought about your master, it's like the unforgivable sin. And finally, I realized, you know, if I get mad at her, there's nothing wrong with that. And I just sit there and think, okay, come on, you know, one day I got really angry. And I left chopping wood, and the first time I heard the voice of the Lord of the house came out of the blue before I knew anything about it. All of a sudden, this voice said to me, "Are you through?"
Yes, you have to take it moment by moment.
Moment by moment.
Moment by moment, really.
It seems to me there's a tendency to think of virtue as something that we acquire from the outside, as opposed to...
And it's pulling up every little weed.
As opposed to something that is a part of our inherent nature, it's something that comes up as we accept and still.
Other than that, is there other things that will hold you back from having a good meditation? That's the mind,
If you worry about these things, it will stop you meditating. You have to not worry about them. You have to deal with them as they come up moment by moment. But if you sit there and worry about them in your meditation, then you're never going to meditate.
In other words, you can erase it as it goes along.
As it goes along, correct, yes. If you worry about it, then you're going to get this incredible mountain which is sitting there saying, virtue. And you can't scale me. I am virtue. Instead of seeing that what it really is this miserable little weed. It's Jack and the Beanstalk.
I know. I don't think I do really horrible things, but these little things are the things that...
Yes. And those are the little ones that you've always got to keep picking up as they happen. I have noticed in me that certain thoughts will come up from my childhood, conditioned from my childhood. And I can control them absolutely if I want to. And if I don't, I've actually experimented with this to see how it works. And I can control them absolutely if I wish, or I can let them come up, in which case they'll get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then I'll say one. I tried a very interesting experiment on that, but it better be only for the monks. Yes?
In the book it says, do not criticize, but accept everything.
Yes.
And I can see where you sit, and that's it.
Don't be, it means really, don't be negative. Yes. It doesn't mean that you deliberately sit down and become a doormat for everybody and the next door neighbor.
And you can use judgment.
Oh, yes. We have had problems in the priory with a next door neighbor who loves to let his dog bark all night. Now, you do not sit there and accept the dog barking all night and get no sleep. You ring the man up and tell him his dog's barking. But you don't call him all the names you can think of in the middle of the night because his dog barked. Yes. You're not trying to hurt the man. You're merely saying, why don't you take a look at your dog? Maybe he wants something.
You know, this ties in very well with your question in one sense, because when you wake up and you hear the dog you're not angry, you're just awake, and you're in the dark. And then you think, oh no, again. Now, that too is kind of a natural thing, but you just, when you just will not accept that that dog is barking, but you're awake anyway, then you tense up and you're fighting it. You go through this whole procedure by refusing to accept it. But if you accept it and remain still within the circumstances, then you can get up and call your neighbor without chewing them out through the phone. And this is the same as your question about when a thought arises, there's nothing wrong with that thought arising, because volition is something that occurs after the thought. I mean, if you have, at a moment you might see that you have a possibility to act in a certain way, but you haven't taken it to the point of volition, of deciding to really be angry. You know, in the precept it says, do not be angry. It doesn't say don't have anger. Don't occasionally get angry. It says don't be angry, which means choosing that volitional self.
A couple of other things I'd like to mention on the subject matter of the lecture. And that is the last two pages that I asked you to read, pages 182 and 183, are my description of contemplation, what takes place in contemplation. And you should know that occasionally, even when one is in the contemplative state, that even then visions will occasionally arise. And don't think that you've gone backwards because suddenly something's popped out. Don't get worried about it. It will occasionally happen. You don't get any more worried about it then than you did when it happened the first go. So don't worry about that. And two other signs of the thing being real. One is a longing for everybody else to be there and a sheer and absolute joy in anybody else who makes it. This is not something that you want as an individual, privately owned thing. I got it, and I'm gonna keep it, and I don't want to share it. There's a longing to share it with everyone, an incredible joy at how many, that the simple fact that everybody else has got the ability to do it. There is nothing quite like the joy of knowing that everybody else can make it. And the other thing is that every time somebody has a third kensho, they seem to write a colossal book. And I've never yet known anybody that doesn't do it. And as I've told you, the system in the East is that everybody has them printed. There's always some rich Buddhist around who will have the 1,000 or 2 printed for all the people in that particular line, and they will be sent out. And this is a sort of cross-cultural certification, if you like. Because after I'd sent several of these to Japan and to one or two other places, I started receiving them from all other people. Oh, by the way, this one's just come out. Have you seen this one? And this has happened in it. That's very close to what happened in yours. And you're doing this lovely cross-cultural realization. Everybody else is recognizing you and sending you their version of it. And if you go through, you find exactly the same set of steps in each one. Each one's seen it slightly differently. Each one has seen a slightly different type of fountain. Each one has felt the water or the honey or whatever you like to call it to be slightly different, but it was always liquid. And so it goes on throughout the entire world. You'll find it very fascinating. So you'll always know when you've done it right.
Said before about being sensitive, looking at a tree and seeing it as an expression of the cosmic Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Could great music be an expression of cosmic Buddha?
I don't see why not.
I don't either, but I just...
I don't see why anything can't. I've never found anything that can't be. I have occasionally wondered about some things like the latest rock group called Kiss. But if you work at it and you have faith, it can be managed. It requires faith, but it can be managed. Yes.
Could you talk to us a little bit about not selling the wine of delusion?
Not selling the wine of delusion. One of the gravest crimes in Buddhism is to pretend to an understanding or a realization that you have not actually had. In other words, to say that you've had Kensho experience or to teach before your words are ripe because of the way in which you can lead other people astray. This is how people get led into quietism that I've talked about, how they get led off, and in the end, Manson, which has been mentioned here this afternoon, is an excellent example of the wine of delusion. He takes good words, "Do you love me?" which he says to his people, and the next thing is, "If you love me, would you do anything for me?" And to which the answer is yes. "If I told you to kill for me, would you do it?" And he's already over the line. Now, the old Buddhist saying of, if the master tells you to kill him, or if the master asks you to kill, what would you do? The rightful answer to that is, if he's a true master, he's never going to ask me. Because he can't break the precepts any more than I can. This is not a cutesy pie question. It's a certainty that you know that the master really is at one with the cosmic Buddha, and therefore is not going to ask you to do anything that is contrary to the will of the cosmic Buddha. But you see the difference in the dividing line? Before you know this situation, before you are in a situation where you truly know these things, you may very well be teaching the wine of delusion. I've taken an extremely coarse, disgusting case, the Manson situation. But that is how you take a good thing which is going nicely along the right road and then suddenly go off at a tangent from it. Yes, of course.
On this precept about the wine of delusion, it's given on two levels. One is do not drink the wine of delusion, the other is do not sell the wine of delusion. And the first level is to don't immerse yourself delusive
material.
Right, reading things. Sometimes you just. I can remember before I became a monk, there was an awful lot of heavy delusion going on in rock music. Just a lot of it. And that's a good example of it. You can just really suck it up if you want to. And it gets you into a kind of very weird state of mind.
And it can be done very subtly, too. You can have people who are really good or seem to be tremendously good, and then one or two things, perhaps because of past conditioning or what's happened in their own lifetime, have got really peculiar things going on in their heads. I know of one person who seems to be quite reasonable, and then suddenly this person will come out with a comment like, a baby is a parasite on its mother's body, both when it's inside the womb and when it's born. Now, anybody who says that is up the spout. But the rest of what that person is saying sounds fairly good. Or a lot of what that person is saying sounds fairly good. And then every now and then you get these things, and they get magnified into something else by the people who are listening to that person. And that is the most dangerous of all forms of wine of delusion. Depends how aware you are when you're doing it. There are times I can play the piano and I don't drink in the delusion. There are times when I can play it and I've now got to the state when I can literally break off in the middle of a bar and just flee from the piano because I'm not in a state when I can really keep the desire for the thing out of the way and I'm not going to let it happen. Happened a couple of nights ago. Somebody asked me to play their piano for them.
That all of the precepts interweave because you were talking
yeah.
about how you
You always have to watch these little weeds. That's a weed, as far as I'm concerned.
But none of the precepts specifically concerns itself with sex. And I was wondering how they interweave to deal with that.
Yeah, there is one.
Yes, there is.
Do not indulge in sexuality, which is actually a key phrase for all of the precepts. Do not indulge. That's the key word.
In other words, it's saying sex is not wrong, except when you indulge in it. There's a lot of difference between having sex and indulging in it.
Indulging in sexuality.
Yes.
Interesting point.
Yeah.
Because sexuality is a delusion in that sense.
It all depends how far you go in any direction. When you are... Remember I said six parts of the full stomach support the doctor and the other two support... six parts support the man and the other two support the doctor? Well, don't do it to such an extent that you make yourself... Don't use sex to such an extent that you make yourself sick, because there is absolutely nothing else in your life other than indulgence. There's nothing wrong with it as a basic thing, any more than there's anything wrong with eating.
In Kaysan's version, does it do not covet?
No.
Because I don't see it in Zen's Eternal Life, in Shishobi.
It should be.
Look under the
Kyoju Kaimon. Well... All right, friends. Monday is our last meeting.